Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Today on the program, local author Christian Geary joins us to talk about her first book titled A Heart Full of Hope, a memoir detailing the challenges of growing up and the inevitable stumbles and triumphs that come along the way. At 9:30, Science Questions explores a new trend in education at community colleges across the nation, industry in the classroom, particularly the biotech industry, part of a national push to prepare more students for the workforce.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Science.
Questions.
Radio.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Susie Montgomery.
The strength of the STEM workforce is viewed as the nation's ability to sustain itself. Based on a 2008 congressional report, there was a growing concern that the United States is not preparing enough students, teachers, and practitioners in the areas of science, technology, engineering, and math, known as STEM. In a recent international assessment of 15-year-old students, the U.S. ranked 24th in science literacy, and moreover, the U.S. ranked only 20th among all nations in the number of 24-year-olds who earn degrees in science or engineering.
An integral part of the public education agenda of the United States is to make sure citizens are well-versed in STEM fields. Biotechnology is the field of applied biology that involves the use of living cells to improve the quality of life, such as in drug production, gene therapy, cloning, and biofuels. Biotechnology has been identified by the U.S. Department of Labor as one of the 14 sectors projected to add substantial numbers of new jobs to the economy. To supply the workforce, biotechnology programs at community colleges are rapidly expanding. So far, there are about 160 biotech programs around the nation.
The national organization called BioLink is helping programs to grow. The group brings together science educators with the common goal of promoting biotechnology programs in community colleges across the nation. Elaine Johnson is the director.
It might not be the right model for every discipline or every industry, but for biotech, where there were new areas coming up, some areas in biofuels, some areas in diagnostics, some area in production of pharmaceuticals or biologics, you have to have leadership from those different regions. And that has happened.
Her love is behind this.
BioLink member Rob Hatherill is professor of biology at Del Mar College in Corpus Christi, Texas.
She networks with everyone. She's like just this incredible lady. I can't say enough about her. Really, single-handedly has brought this whole vision together and has kept it sustainable.
Johnson is accomplishing the BioLink mission. The programs are serving as a direct link between education and the biotech industry. Industry plays a role in educating students, making sure they have specific hands-on skills to work in their laboratories. Producer Susie Montgomery attended the BioLink Summer Fellows Forum in Berkeley, California.
Here, a group of passionate educators are working together to develop models for teaching biotechnology in the classroom. Jim DeClos is director of the biotechnology program at Solano Community College in the California Bay Area. In the mid-1990s, he was a visiting scientist at the biotechnology company Genentech to develop a training program for students who could then work at the company.
I am a classically trained academic, and I don't know anything about manufacturing. They said, well, that would be fine. Why don't you come down and we'll teach you.
DeClos' internship at Genentech turned out to have an enormous consequence. Here is his surprising biotech story.
And it was Thanksgiving weekend. My son came down with a fever. My son was 4 years old, Jefferson, and he woke up one morning, and it wasn't a bad fever, 102. And I thought, well, I wonder if we should take him in. I asked my wife, What are your instincts? Should we take them in? You don't want to go to the emergency room and have them think that you're a hypochondriac for a minor fever. On the other hand, he was delirious and things didn't sound right. And she said, my instincts say take him in. Then let's take him in. Had we not taken him in, he would have been dead within 4 hours. So we took him to the local emergency room, and he started to develop a rash that turned out to be a petechial rash, that is, all of the blood started clotting in his body. And the attending physician there said, turned to the nurse and said, I need an airlift, and I need it here in 5 minutes. So they airlifted him to Oakland Children's Hospital, and it turned out that he had meningococcemia. Meningococcemia is due to the same bacteria that is the most common type of bacteria in meningitis, in bacterial meningitis. But in this case, it gets into the blood. And when it gets in the blood, it's almost always fatal. And it's almost always fatal that day. So by the time we arrived at Oakland Children's Hospital, he was in the intensive care unit, and the physician said, here's how it is, Dad. We'll try to save him. If he survives, he'll likely lose all of his limbs. Brain function, we'll worry about brain function sometime next month. Do you have any questions? Oh, no, not right now. But we'd like to try something, and I'd like the hematologist to talk to you about it. So the hematologist came up to me and said, I'm Dr. Singer, I'd like to try a thrombolytic. And I said, a thrombolytic, that's what you have to do. He has blood clots everywhere. A thrombolytic is an enzyme that digests blood clots. If you give him this enzyme, it'll digest the blood clots and restore blood flow so that he won't lose limbs. And she said, you know what about thrombolytics? I said, you have to give him TPA. It's a Genentech product. By the way, I was making TPA last year. I know all about TPA. She said, well, you know, take your time because it's an off-label use. It's just been tried a couple of times. There are tremendous risks. And I'd like to sit you down and explain the risk. I think you should do it right away because I know the risk. As a matter of fact, there's no drug I know better than TPA, and I know exactly what the risks are. And the risks are that if he had an aneurysm, if he had a break in a blood vessel in his brain, you can imagine that with a break in a blood vessel, if you give a drug, an enzyme that digests blood clots, the blood will just start flowing, not stop, and he'll die immediately. So I said, go ahead. And it's one of those situations where they say, take your time to make a decision in this high risk for procedure. But on the other hand, the clock is ticking. And my experience in biotechnology allowed me to quickly make the call to say, I'd like to trust science. I'd like to trust biotechnology. I'd like to trust this particular drug, tissue plasminogen activator, an enzyme that digests blood clots. And to cut to the chase, they infused him with TPA, and his deep, deep purple that was all present all over his body began to lighten up. So when I went to the ICU unit and saw him, he was purple all over his body. If you think about the deepest bruise that you've ever had, he was that over 100% of his body, except his fingers and toes were turning necrotic black. And that was the circumstance that we were in. When they started to put the TPA into the drip that was in the IV, he started to lighten up. Where his limbs were stone cold, warmth started to spread throughout them. That is, the enzyme went in, digested all the blood clots, and saved his life. This drug, biotechnology, the field of biotechnology, saved my son's life from certain death. And so if you would like an advocate for the field of biotechnology, you can find no better advocate than me.
Biotech education model of training a workforce with specific skills for local and regional industry is making its way into four-year college programs.
I'm realizing that the boundaries between biotech and biology are blurring.
Jim Price is a professor of biology at Utah Valley University.
He describes himself as having a purist mentality when it comes to biology, and he thought the influence of industry would surely threaten biology education.
I'm a biologist because I marvel at the complexity and wonder and beauty of the natural world. And so to me, biotech, it kind of put me off. But I went into biotech at my institution because I saw it as an opportunity to bring resources to the students to get the equipment that we should have had all along to give the students the opportunity to do cutting-edge experiments, or at least see cutting-edge experiments being done, see cutting-edge techniques.
Biotech programs are still in their inception and remain under the radar in the realm of education. Sandra Porter is president of Digital World Biology. To help get the word out, she is compiling data on all the programs, which tend to attract non-traditional students.
And every program has such wonderful stories. They know about students who were on welfare, maybe, and had four kids and came to community college and got a job, and now they've advanced to a management position and people ask them how to do math problems. And all of this sounds really good, but when you talk to each person, it all sounds anecdotal. And it isn't until you start to see that these stories happen with every one of the 160 biotech programs. These aren't just unusual anecdotes. This is how the biotechnology education field is, and this is how BioLink is.
It is clear students are getting practical skills that are less about the research and more specific to the job. Luann Wolfgren is chair of biotechnology at the Johnson County Community College in Kansas.
A plus B equals C type of science lab, they get really distraught when they don't get an answer or it wasn't quite the right answer. And my response to them is, welcome to the real world of science. Whatever data you get is the data you get. And you have to interpret that and you have to be able to think. And unfortunately, a lot of science education in this country in the past hasn't really been that way. It's gone for the ooh and the ah and not the think about. This country has suffered in its science and math education for a number of years, and it's got to turn around because this is the way the world is going. And we're either going to destroy it or we're going to fix it.
Undergraduate student Corey Robinson is a biotech intern at the University of California, Berkeley. She offers her perspective on these programs.
Having an internship like this sort of sets you apart from everyone else who just says, well, yeah, I study biology and I like science. Well, prove it. You know, what have you done? What can you show me? Show me something on your resume, and this is a wonderful thing to have.
Students Chaz Downey and Jennifer Chancellor are also interns here.
We're going to be working with single-celled organism and extremophile, looking for proteins, working towards finding renewable energy, biofuels, cellulosic breakdown. Microbiology is the way a lot of science is going, and that's what we're working on over the summer, so I'm getting a lot of hands-on experience with that beforehand. No matter what I do, the things that I'm learning now are going to be applicable to just about anything.
The program that I'm in made me a more disciplined person, more responsible and focused on achieving my goals and making a better life for myself and my daughter.
I've just always been interested in sort of how things work. You know, if we were at the beach and you'd see a fish, I was like, well, how does it breathe underwater? Not necessarily why is the sky blue, but a lot of learning about animals. And I remember one time I went to Montessori school, so it was really hands-on, and a bird flew into these big glass windows that we had, and sort of as a learning project we dissected the bird, and I must have been five or something, but the bird's one eyeball was bigger than its brain. And I was just like, that is so fascinating. Like, this bird must be so dumb, but it needs vision much more than like we do. And it just really made me think about how, you know, every animal's different, and I want to know why things develop the way that they do.
The goal of the National Science Foundation, or NSF, is to support all fields of fundamental science and engineering. Linnea Fletcher is chair of the biotech program at a community college in Austin, Texas. She is working with NSF to keep them abreast of best teaching practices to use in the classroom.
I was a lab rat.
She quit research and lab work and went into education at the college, where she felt creative freedom.
I was interested in affecting change in education.
and I could start a program at a community college, and I was free to create what I thought was a really good program for educating students. I even have a really big high school program there, too, because I found that I enjoy turning people on to science, mm-hmm. period. Because, you know, turning people on to science, when you realize they literally, when I go outside, I see science, I see nature, I see ecology. Everything about me is like a laboratory.
Fletcher hopes to help others see what she sees in science.
Science is actually beautiful. But if you look at a lot of the successful science companies, you'll find that they actually appreciate art, too, because art and science are very similar. They're both beautiful.
Signing up for her classes simulates an on-the-job experience at a biotech company.
At community colleges and workforce programs, you have to make it right 100% of the time, and you have to have soft skills. So you have to show up on time. I mean, I lock the door. I'll know when someone's late, kind of thing. We actually run a lot of our courses like you're at a company, kind of thing. You sign a contract that you are essentially going to act in the proper manner. You read it in terms of what it's like to take this program, these courses, show up on time, all of this, and you sign off on this.
It is a challenging program. Students have to figure out why something doesn't work before they are allowed to move on.
And that's kind of new for students, the idea of mastering a technique before you're allowed to progress. And you know, in industry, there's no such thing as you just 50% of the time make something correct. You have to make it right 100% of the time. And that's not necessarily true in education.
But still, with so much potential to expand these programs, the success remains stifled.
Essentially, faculty at community colleges in science programs like biology and biotech are totally invisible because they don't have to publish to get tenure, like four-year faculty. And I realized this being at the National Science Foundation. And as a result, what we're doing in the classroom is not getting out. And we're doing some pretty amazing things.
The Network BioLink director, Elaine Johnson and company, provided Fletcher with so many resources and good curriculum that she could get her program going with ease.
I had so much curriculum. I had so many good ideas that it was like I got this hot start. Boom, went off the ground. And so I was able to establish a high school program, and we have over 1,000 students now in our high school program, and it's self-sustaining. By helping each other, you know, we build the leadership capacity within the biotech community. And so the original group has to turn around and mentor the next group, who turns around and mentors the next group, and you just pass it along, and everybody takes a piece of the pie.
Because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well.
Here in Utah, we have about 24 biotech companies. State of Utah science advisor Tammy Goetz is working on increasing that number. Colleague Jim DeClo is well acquainted with Goetz's work.
Tammy Goetz is one of those forces of nature that the minute that you meet her, you will never forget her. And she's a tremendous asset to the state of Utah. I can't state that well enough. She is a ball of fire with idea after idea.
Through her tenacity, Goetz was able to bring the two-year biotech program to the Salt Lake Community College in 2001. A time when a Utah State University study revealed significant growth in the life sciences and a growing need for skilled workers in technical and scientific areas.
One of the things that makes a two-year program at Salt Lake Community College unique in Utah, but similar to all the other programs across the country, is that the skills and aptitudes that were identified in the early days and then used to create the courses and their content were defined and driven by industry in Utah. So, you know, the students that graduate from the two-year program at Salt Lake Community College, as well as the new four-year degree, or relatively new four-year degree out of Utah Valley University, you know, these students walk out with the skills and aptitudes that industry have said we need.
The life science industries, biotech included, played a major role in Utah's economy and encompass medical devices, pharmaceuticals, and dietary supplements. Goetz brought many of these industry leaders into the classroom.
You know, it's funny because I realized very quickly that there are a lot of scientists out there and even engineers that are closet teachers. And once you get them out of the closet and into the classroom, they're amazing. And, you know, what's a more credible instructor in a classroom than the vice president of engineering at, you know, at Czar's? You know, Wade Hull came in and, along with his colleagues, taught the students about the whole process of how a company begins and in the life cycle of the company and taking a medical device into the market. And, you know, that could be a pretty dry and crunchy topic if it's taught by the wrong person. But when you have somebody who's actually doing it and lived it and has the scars and, you know, the battle wounds to show for it, the students perk up. I mean, they get it. They know this person's for real. And I think any program worth a hill of beans will continue to involve industry in a very significant, substantial way.
Wade Hull.
So a few of us, including Czar's Farm and Nelson Labs, we were able to be a little bit selfish and say, hey, these are kind of the skills and attributes that we would like to see in people coming out of the program.
North Carolina is forging ahead with well over 500 biotech companies.
Bill Woodruff
is director of the oldest biotech program in the nation, located at Alamance Community College in North Carolina.
My only real con, and it's only in that I have to do more legwork is what it comes down to, but the real con is that they only want me to do what's going to, you know, prepare people for their company.
So many companies make it difficult to train for specific skills.
North Carolina has really been emphasizing the biotech industry to sort of supplement the loss in tobaccos and furniture and textiles. And so this is their big baby to bring it up, because now we are ranked number 3 in the country in biotechnology. So my class size is now, my program size, is around 80 to 85 strong.
Woodruff has been affectionately referred to as the godfather of biotech. He estimates at least 90% of his students get biotech jobs.
Early on, they would go in at entry level, but very quickly move up because they were so skill enriched. You know, I mean, you can go to a 4-year school, and I don't say anything against 4-year schools. Obviously, I've been through them, but it's content that they're given there. It's concepts. They can't afford with thousands of students to actually do the hands-on stuff. And so when my students go in, they still have the concepts. We run labs and lectures just like you would a university. But they have the skills that from day one they start working. And so they're very attractive to the industry. And so it's been very successful.
The programs are expanding at community colleges because they have more flexibility than universities, says Jim DeClos, director of biotechnology at Solano College.
The other secret that no one ever talks about is that the academic enterprise tends to be relatively conservative. University professors think of themselves as innovative and progressive, but when they get together, there always is this concern of, is the level of rigor high enough? And that tends to suppress innovation. And so at the community college level, we can innovate in a way that probably the constraints of university life don't allow them to do.
Wade Hull was educated through the traditional university system.
One could say that it's community colleges against universities, but in essence, their areas of focus are likely somewhat different and complementary. I think the universities are recognizing in an increasing manner now the importance of industry feedback, and maybe that's something that community colleges have been able to implement more readily or more quickly. It's probably a little more difficult for a university to create a new degree or to change a curriculum than it is for a more facile or adept community college to adjust. But I think generally both recognize the value of industry. And universities are steep in tradition, and that's one of their strengths. So traditional disciplines such as chemistry, physics, biology, and the core engineering disciplines have been around for decades, if not centuries. So to create a new program, an academic department or a group, is likely quite difficult in the established university setting. For example, about 5 years ago, the University of Utah established a biomedical engineering undergraduate degree. And they, for years, had had a bioengineering graduate degree, which was very well regarded. As I hire engineers, I think the industry is still learning what a biomedical engineer is. And so that's maybe one of the struggles. Anytime you have something new, it takes some time to define it and to establish its place in the arena.
Hull also notes there are new programs at the University of Utah focusing on industry needs. Some universities, like the University of Utah, are starting programs geared towards training students in lab skills needed by the local companies. For now, biotechnology students are well-suited to fill industry positions.
But in most cases, you know, the type of analyses and the work that's being done can be capably completed by individuals who have, you know, 1 or 2 years training in the lab. So we're able to kind of divide and conquer our workload and have individuals with technician-type skills and training do a lot of the work that we are having more advanced PhD scientists do. And so it's allowed us to be more productive.
In fact, DeClos says they are seeing an increase in university graduates attending their programs.
Universities are under quite a bit of change, and especially in California, where we have a $20 billion deficit, they're under a lot of pressure to do things more economically, and what that often has meant is they've minimized the amount of lab that the student has to take for their degree, and so we supply that additional lab in a post-baccalaureate way, which is really a new role for community colleges that we did not predict would happen until the students began to show up. And in a lot of classes, 50% of our students will have bachelor's degrees or higher.
After hearing about industry and their role in science education, we wanted to talk to a university professor about industry playing a role in the classroom. Sherry Quinn has more.
We wanted to know how well the biology department at the University of Utah felt they prepared students for the workplace. A confidential source on the biology department faculty had this response.
We should do a better job since there are more jobs outside of academia than in it. The problem is, teachers have stayed in academia, so that is all we know. Industry jobs should not be considered dropping out of science. Fewer students would think they wanted to be doctors if they knew of other exciting jobs. I think we burn out a lot of good students on the pre-med track.
The growing need for a skilled workforce is challenging traditional science education. The emerging biotechnology programs at community colleges are getting a head start. Russ Reed, executive director of the Center for the National Biotechnology Workforce in North Carolina, helped develop them.
I think that, you know, for the nation itself right now, it's this whole idea of making sure that people aren't fearing science, that you can actually make a good, healthy living out of it, and in particular, biotechnology is growing by leaps and bounds. So the future looks bright.
The conference summed up with connecting BioLink and biotechnology to vision and change. They certainly have a vision, and it'll be interesting to see how community college biotech programs influence the future of science education. For Science Questions, I'm Susie Montgomery.
In conclusion, our series, Postcards from Outer Space, highlights science in the classroom, recognizing that an interest in science is something that develops over a lifetime and starts early. Wasatch Elementary third grade teacher Kathy Travers developed an assignment blending science with creative writing.
And they were incredibly motivated to do both writing and reading and research. And if you can get kids to be excited about reading and writing and research and science, then yeah, it's something you want to do again.
The students researched anything that was in outer space and then wrote postcards about it to someone on Earth.
Hi, my name is Ina, and I'm 9 years old, and I'm writing from the sun. Hi, Mama. I'm burning up here. It's 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Did you know that the sun has 99.8% of the mass in the solar system? And the sun's surface is called the photosphere? Oh, yeah. Don't worry. I'm wearing 300 layers of sunscreen. Love, Ina.
And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening.
Science Questions is brought to you by SQ Productions and a Utah Public Radio and KRCL partnership.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by the Kinney College of Natural Resources at Utah State University, where students and faculty promote the sustainability of ecosystems and the communities that depend on them. Information is at cnr.usu.edu. And support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where graduates' acceptance rates to medical, dental, and graduate schools exceed national averages. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Memories of growing up conjure up a multitude of experiences and emotions that can linger throughout a lifetime. Christy and Gary from Salt Lake City. Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Memories of growing up conjure up a multitude of experiences and emotions that can linger throughout a lifetime. Christy and Gary from Salt Lake City shares her personal reflections on what she calls an ordinary life.
Science.
Questions.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Memories of growing up conjure up a multitude of experiences and emotions that can linger throughout a lifetime. Christy and Gary from Salt Lake City shares her personal reflections on what she calls an ordinary life. In her first book, A Heart Full of Hope, a memoir, it is a collection of short stories that detail the beauty, the heartbreak, and the complexity that emerged throughout her life. She reads the story, My Life's Purpose.
I nursed a sick husband for 16 years until he left me for a better place. Together, we raised a challenged daughter to be very self-sufficient. Because of our encouragement, she has accomplished more than anyone ever thought she possibly could. I was insistent that she be everything she could be, and then some. We raised a son who, given the challenge of coping with an ill father and a handicapped sister, rose above those difficulties and became a man with great character, a man of whom I am extremely proud. When he was a little boy, I heard him tell his friends, "My daddy doesn't go on business trips. He goes to the hospital." My heart broke into pieces and has never quite recovered. Perhaps seeing my family through these seemingly ordinary events is my life purpose. Sometimes I think we have to stop and rest and just let the universe guide us to where we are needed on our paths. It really doesn't take much to make me happy. The first robin in spring to make a wish upon, a penny from heaven at my feet, a perfect tiny bird's nest that has been mystically fallen from the sky and been left just for me as I walk to my car, and my dogs who make me feel serene, like when I listen to the sounds my sweet Nike makes as she sleeps, and the nudging and cuddling of my little poodle Phoebe as she lies under the safety of our blankets at night. Then there is the sight and aroma of my garden, and the sheer delight of being able to watch things grow and use some of them in my cooking. The look of love from my sweet husband's eyes, which I can conjure up from my plentiful memory bank, as he watched me from his chair while I rubbed his aching feet. Oh, those beautiful blue eyes that would light up at the sight of the first rose I would offer him in spring to intoxicate all his senses. There have been times in my life when I know that I have been able to create what I consider to be miracles. I have never looked upon these events as anything no one else could do. I am simply aware of and look for the signs that I know are being left for me, and then I proceed to make my miracle happen. I can be quite determined when I want something. Obviously, I don't always get what I want, but I'm sure I get what I need. I have the knowledge that I will always have enough money to share and spare. I know that as long as I am alive and beyond that, my children will never go without.
I know that I will always have a few kindred spirits in my life to keep me in check. My life purpose? I don't know. I think I'm living it. As long as there are friends, family, music, flowers, good food for my table, my dogs, health, sunshine, and good wine, I will be happy. For these are the treasures that feed my soul. If you remember the Dick and Jane books, the first word we learned was look. Perhaps, with the reading of this story, you may not have to look very hard to find your life purpose.
So you said there's a story behind that story.
There is a story behind this story, this particular story, My Life Purpose. In 2008, I went to an angel card reader, and he sent me home with homework, which I was quite taken aback at. I thought, what the heck is he doing, giving me homework? But he said, I want you to go home, and I want you to write your life purpose. And I balked at that because I had never written before. And it took me a couple of days, but I finally sat down and put pen to paper. And for some unknown reason, I just began to write. And it was almost like automatic writing. I couldn't stop until I got to the end of the story. I didn't read it, didn't edit it. I called my friend, the angel card reader, and I said, okay, I'm done. Now what? And he says, okay, let me get situated. And he did, and he said, okay, let me hear it. And I read it and got to the end, and there was silence. And I said, are you still there? And he said, yeah, I'm here. And he was obviously crying. And he said, Christine, do you realize what just happened here? And I said, no. He said, you're a writer. You are a natural writer. And your words need to be heard. And that's how this book started. With that one story. And then I became inspired. And I don't know how, but maybe it was the universe calling to me. I don't know, but just started writing stories. And I started posting them on Open Salon and received so many wonderful comments that I was being prompted to put them into a book, compile them into a memoir.
How would you describe the collection of stories? It's a memoir, but how would you summarize all the stories? And how long did it take you to compile all of these? When did you start writing?
It took me about, I would say, 2 years, 2.5 years. I have been pondering putting them into a book for a long time. And then finally one day I said, that's it, I'm just going to do it. And I think of these stories, yes, as a memoir, mainly as a gift for my children and my grandchildren. I think of it as immortality, that I will live on through these words. And someday a great-grandchild's going to pick this book up and say, wow, my grandma was really weird. I mean, she went through some trying times, but she came out okay in the end. But writing these stories was very cathartic because they are a collection of stories that are, they have a message for everyone. Everyone can identify, especially women, I would say, can identify with these stories. There are stories of great sorrow and pain, but there's also a lot of humor. And I like to think that they may start out on a sorrowful note, but they end up with either a lesson or a message and on an uplifting note.
And so your mother's passing at age 12, you were age 12, right? And that was such a tumultuous time anyway, that
age. And so that must have been a very significant time in your life that has continued to influence you. And do you think that was a big part of your passion for writing? And
I think that it's an ongoing process with me coming to terms with having a mother who did not show love. And I'm still trying to figure that one out. Her inability to love, to care. And now I don't know what the reason was behind it. But it has taken me on a path of writing a lot about that. However, I try not to dwell on it too much. There are a few stories I left out of the book on purpose because I thought, no, I don't want to go there again. But it has absolutely influenced my life and how I have raised my children. Hopefully, a little better. More hugs and kisses and loves and caring.
And you grew up in a fairly big family, right? How many siblings?
I had 2 sisters and 3 brothers, all older. I am the baby. And I think I was in a good position, actually. Doesn't sound right to say a good position, but the best position for losing my mother, because I was able to pretty much raise myself because everyone was older and almost out of the house. And I kind of went my own way and said no when the others said yes. I said no to a lot of the things that I think that I would have been so different if my mother had been around, because I would not have taken the chances that I did and become the person that I am today. And I feel I'm more independent. I had to forge my own way. And I think because of that, I made a lot of mistakes, but I grew so much. And I don't think I would have been able to do that if she was there, because she would have held me back. Something that's kind of significant to me was when my mother lay dying, her last words to me were, "Be a good girl." And I didn't think about that very much until lately when I was writing a story. And I thought, even on her deathbed, she couldn't say, "I love you." She said, "Be a good girl." Well, I was a good girl. But I think she should have said, "I love you."
Why do you think that was such a hard phrase for your parents and within your family?
My parents grew up in a very hard time, probably, you know, during the Depression. They both of them didn't make it past 9th grade. However, they became very successful people. My father became a businessman, and they pushed their children to the limits, and we all received college educations. 5 teachers, 1 dentist, and they were not given, I don't think they were given the love. So I just think it was a repetitive pattern, mm-hmm. that they didn't know any better, and they just did the best they could.
Your life is ordinary. In some ways you were disappointed. You've come to realize that actually there are a lot of miracles in that ordinary life. And can you talk about what does that mean to you, an ordinary life, and how has this collection of stories changed your impression of what that means?
I think we all lead ordinary lives. I remember Tipper Gore was on a talk show once, and she said, you know, we are all ordinary people. We're just placed in extraordinary circumstances. And so I truly believe we're all really leading ordinary lives. Some of us more ordinary than others, I suppose. But I don't think I've led an extraordinary life. I'm not the president's wife or anything like that. But I think that we all have something to offer. Some of us don't realize what we have to offer. I think when you start meditating or just looking within a little bit deeper into the meanings of life and really looking at what's around you, I think you just need to stop and think, what am I doing? Where am I going? How is this influencing me? How is this influencing my family? I think that's when it becomes extraordinary. When you look at things differently, I have a story that is called A Penny for Your Thoughts, and it's a story written about my sister Frances, who died when she was 25. And in the story, I talk about the fact that we wore penny loafers, and she would take the pennies out of her penny loafers and she would hold them up and say, "Penny for your thoughts." And also, and in this story, I talk about how I never, ever pass a penny by on the street because I know she sends me pennies. I just think we need to look for these things and take the signs that we need to take in order to forge our path.
So the title, Heartful of Hope, what does that mean to you? Why did you title the book Heartful of Hope?
I zeroed in on that title because we live in such trying times. And I have a story in there titled On Being Pollyanna. And I think too many people dwell on all the sadness, all the destruction, all the horrible things happening in the world. I do not close my eyes to these things, but I prefer to concentrate on hope. There is courage in the word hope, and we have to be courageous, and courage comes from the word. The root word of courage is heart. And so I think that's how I developed this title. I am the ultimate optimist. I do get down at times, that's for sure. I do get depressed. But then I have to concentrate on gratitude. And I keep a gratitude journal. And just walking outside and looking at my flowers gives me hope.
What do you hope that readers will get from these collection of stories? Do you have an idea of what you want people to get from it, or that what you want to give to them with these stories?
I would love for someone to read one of these stories and say, "Wow, I've been there. I know what that's like." And it's really good that somebody else has been there too, and I can identify with that. All of these stories, everybody can identify on some level with each of these stories, because they are truth, they're honest, they're heartfelt. They can be anyone's story. I just want readers just to take a little bit of that with them, a little joy, even sadness, that somebody else has been there and has put it into words and maybe helped them. I'm not looking for praise. I just feel like I'm an ordinary person, and I've just written this book, and I hope it will help people. That's all.
Christine leaves us as she reads from one of the stories called A Message from a Butterfly.
While working in my garden a couple of summers ago, I turned around in an effort to till yet another patch of soil, and out of the corner of my eye I spotted a type of butterfly which I had never laid eyes on before. Quietly gasping in delight,
I sat down and stared at this beautiful creature who had alighted atop a pot of colorful pansies. Bright yellow in color, with black-tipped wings and blue and red spots on his back, he held my rapt attention as he fluttered about, sipping nectar from several flowers repeatedly. At times he seemed to stare back, assuring me that it was indeed all right that I invade his privacy. It was difficult to ascertain who was the interloper. The butterflies we see are mostly small, white, or yellow in color, who sweetly flit from one flower to another, constantly helping to make the garden a more beautiful place. This visitor was a rare sight, and I wanted to share it. As unobtrusively as I could, I stealthily made my way into the house to announce to Daniel the arrival of this most unexpected gift. We quietly went outside, and there, much to my surprise, was our welcome friend in his same spot. He seemed to gaze at us for a long time, and then with great fanfare opened his wings and fluttered around, much as a peacock might strut himself about. Then, sweeping around us in a large circular path, the butterfly flew away. We were in such awe of his grandeur that we waited to see if he would return. Unfortunately, he didn't. Unable to erase this vision from my mind, I remembered I had received a book about butterflies for Christmas. I retrieved the book from where it had been left on the bookshelf. When I picked it up, I felt my heart leap. On the front cover was a picture of my butterfly. Upon closer inspection, I discovered it was an eastern tiger swallowtail, which is apparently not an unusual species, except that it is rare to see them where we live. A few days later, as I was on my way to the grocery store, a strong feeling that I needed to go to the library came over me. I wandered the aisles for quite some time before stopping abruptly. Absorbed in scanning books on the shelf, my hand involuntarily reached for one book in particular. As I plucked it out of its place, I noticed it was turned backward. I turned it over, and there on the cover was a huge picture of my butterfly. I began to get an eerie feeling about all of these events. I couldn't help but believe I was being sent a sign.
A Heart Full of Hope by Christine Gary is available online on Amazon, Kindle, and at bookstores, including the King's English and Sam Weller's. Thanks for listening. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah.
Butterfly, flap your wings, 'cause summer in the nighttime sings.
Thank you for listening to Utah Public Radio. This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan. This is Utah Public Radio, Utah's favorite public radio station.
Thank you for listening to Utah Public Radio. This is Addison Pace. I'd like to remind you to please check out our community calendar at upr.org.